Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
And welcome back to Overnight America, now past midnight, live in St. Louis, Missouri. An hour from now, we're going to pick up the conversation again with the State of the Union when we hook up two of the biggest shows in North America. Here in the United States, of course, it's Overnight America. And in Canada, it's called The Late Shift with Drex. He's on all the big Canadian stations, syndicated through the Chorus Network. Those are some really huge talk stations. And the fun thing with him is he's a Canadian, of course. Well, I think he's from Australia, but lives in Canada now, from the Vancouver region. And they pay a lot of attention to American politics. So sometimes during these big events we've hooked up, this will be our second time doing it. That's going to happen about 1 hour from now at 106. So if you want to hear that, we're going to be broadcasting all across North America talking the State of the Union. But first, joining us now is a best-selling author of Business Secrets of the Trappist Monks, but right now has Brother John out, August Turek. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Oh, it's my privilege. Thank you.
So I want to talk about your journey, the journey that led you to where you are today. From what I understand, you used to be in the business world, but left that sort of thing, and you started to learn from Trappist monks. And really, can we talk about that transformation and how that changed your life?
But there was really an overlap there. I was, first of all, my primary focus in my whole life has been spirituality. I like to tell people like to think that I'm a businessman who happened to be interested in spirituality, but actually I considered myself a spiritual seeker who happened to have a profound interest in business on the side. But anyway, I was coaching back in the early 1990s. I started coaching college students. Mm-hmm. And in 1996, I started my own business with a couple other guys in 1993, and we were building the business up. And in 1996, these kids talked me into going skydiving.
Mm.
And as I like to say, I was brave enough to jump out of an airplane, but not brave enough to tell them I didn't want to jump out of no darn airplane. So anyway, I jumped out of the airplane, and I smashed my ankle to smithereens.
Ugh.
And I ended up in the hospital and ended up having these profound panic attacks. And I didn't know where they were coming from until I finally realized I was facing my mortality for the first time. I wasn't ready to die. And even though I knew that this ankle wasn't going to kill me, I knew that, you know, not too far down the road, they were going to be telling me, "I'm sorry, Mr. Turek, but there's nothing more we can do for you." And I wasn't ready to die. And even all the spirituality that I'd done ever since college didn't seem to be there when I needed it. And this launched me on what I now call my 2-year dark night of the soul, because when I got out of the hospital, the panic attacks went away, but I was still extremely depressed. And a few months later, I got a telephone call from another one of my college students telling me he was spending the summer at a Trappist monastery called Mepkin Abbey in Charleston, right outside of Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And before I knew it, I had asked him if I could come, and he went and said, "Well, let me ask Brother John." And that was the first time I ever heard Brother John's name.
Mm-hmm.
I went down that weekend. I went back the next. I was blown away. I went back the next weekend and the next weekend. And then I applied for what is called a monastic guest status, where you can actually become a part-time monk, and you live with the monks and you work with them. And so over Christmas of 1996, I made an arrangement to go down there for a whole month and get up at 3 in the morning with them and work with alongside of them all day. And that was during this Christmas that I had this encounter on Christmas Eve, actually, with Brother John, which later became my book.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Part-time monk. I guess I don't know the classifications. So of a Trappist monk, do they live in a community together? And
yes, they live in a they're a branch of the Benedict, they live the rule of St. Benedict. And they live in a community. The Trappists are like the Marine Corps of monks. They're the ones that before Vatican II would keep silence. And, and their motto is Ora et Labora, which means prayer and work. And they have a business. All the monasteries have businesses that they use to support themselves. So when you're not going to church eight times a day and praying in silence on your own, you're out working. At the time I started going down there, they had 40,000 monks had 40,000 chickens, and they would take the eggs and sell the eggs to the grocery stores and the restaurants in the area. And that's where I would work with them. I would work on their chicken farm with them.
It's a lot of chickens. Well, when you said you walked onto the campus for the first time, you're blown away. What blew you away about it?
Well, there was I'll give you just a real quick story. It was the kindness, and it was confrontational. It was the kindness, the gentleness, the peace, the tranquility. One of the very first times I was there, I was behind this like 90-year-old monk. He was like 88 years old. I later got to know him. His name was Brother Gregory, and he was in front of me in line, it was like a smorgasbord, you know, cafeteria style. And he bent over to get one of the trays that were stacked below the counter, and it seemed to take him forever. And I noticed that I was getting impatient, saying, come on, thinking to myself, come on, you know. And when he finally retrieved this hard-earned tray, he turned around with a big smile and gave it to me.
Huh, how about that?
And I thought, and I was blown away, because I thought, my God, here I am, irritated because this old man has taken so much time, when really, and all the effort it took him, his joy was in giving his hard-earned tray away. Mm-hmm. And I was ashamed, you know. And so there was just a whole bunch of things, little things that happened like that, that just opened my eyes to a whole different way of living. And then of course, I got nailed when Christmas came around, and I had this encounter with Brother John. And what happened was that about 6 or 7 years later, some of my college students challenged me to enter an essay contest. The Templeton Foundation had a contest called the Power of Purpose Essay Contest, and they goaded me into writing something for it. And I'd never written anything for publication before, and this contest was open to previously published material and professional writers. And I looked it up, and I only had a week to write an article, to write my essay, and it had been going on for a year and a half. But I started trying to do it anyway, and I wasn't getting anywhere. Another one of my students said, why don't you just write that story about Brother John and that encounter you had with him on Christmas Eve that you love telling us about? So I wrote it up in like 2 days, 48 hours, and I polished it for another 24 hours, and I sent it off and forgot about it. And then 6 months later, I got a telephone call that I had won the $100,000 grand prize.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? You forget about something like that, and you just don't know if you're going to get a response or not. You kind of write it off. You think, you know, that was fun to do, but there's no way they'll ever get back to me.
So that transformed my life. So I became it was republished in the Best of Christian and the Best of Catholic Writings, and then I happened to write something about why I thought the Trappist monks were great at business, and because I thought to myself, hey, I by this time had sold my businesses, and I was thinking, why are these guys so good at business? They're 65 years old on average. They don't care about business. They only work 4 hours a day. They work in silence, but everything they touch turns to gold. Why is that? Mm-hmm. And I wrote what I thought was a white paper, and somebody gave it to an editor at Forbes, and he published it as a four-part article in Forbes magazine. It went viral and was a smash hit, and that led to an invitation for me to become a leadership contributor for Forbes. And as well, then I got a telephone call from Columbia Business School saying, how about turning that into a book?
Wow.
And that's how I ended up writing Business Secrets of the Trappist Monks as well.
Wow.
So everything has been this series of happy accidents, beginning with my skydiving accident.
How's your ankle feel today?
It's doing great. And I really sincerely can say that the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life was smashing my ankle in that skydiving accident.
Did you have to get some pins put in?
I got 12 pins in there.
Oh, 12 pins. Is it enough to ache when it's about to rain?
Nope. I never have any problem with it at all. The Lord stayed with me so far. Now it's been 23 years.
We're going to continue our conversation with August Turek. He has a new book called Brother John, A Monk, A Pilgrim in the Purpose of Life. His time that he spent at a monastery with Trappist monks, some unbelievable stories and life lessons learned there. We'll ask him that next on Overnight America KMOX. Night America. Joining us is a very special guest, someone that spent time at a monastery, not as a Trappist monk, but among them, August Turek is someone that wrote Business Secrets of the Trappist Monks, but Brother John, a monk, a pilgrim in the purpose of life. When you first walked in and you met Brother John, how did they conduct themselves in a way that you knew something special was going on there?
Well, let me tell you, you and your audience real quickly what happened on this. I think this sums it all up on Christmas Eve. So it's Christmas Eve. This is 1996. I'm down there at the monastery. I'm there because I'm going through the mother of midlife crises. I'm not there just because I'm for the fun of it. And on Christmas Eve at the monastery is the same as almost any other day. You get up at 3 in the morning. You go to church 8 times a day. You work all day long. But the only difference is instead of going to bed at 8 o'clock at night, you stay up because Mass, there's a Christmas Mass at 8 o'clock that goes till about 10. And then afterwards, they have a very rare thing. They have a party.
Hmm.
And they serve cookies and cakes and apple cider, et cetera. So I went to this party, all of a sudden I realized I'm dead on my feet. It's 11 o'clock at night. I've been up since 3 in the morning. And I head for the door to get back to my room, and it's pounding down rain on the roof. And it's 38 degrees outside. All I've got is my monastic surplice that I wear when I'm there. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get soaked and I won't be able to, be soaked from tomorrow morning, too. And as I open the door, the light pours out, and suddenly I realize there's somebody standing under an umbrella outside, and I see that it's Brother John. And I said, Brother John, what are you doing? And he said, I'm here to walk anybody who forgot their umbrella back to their room.
Mm. Wow.
And he starts walking me back to my room, and I'm just blown away, Ryan. I'm thinking, my God, this man works harder than anybody. He's been a monk for 50 years. He gets one party a year, and he would rather stand outside in 38-degree weather just in case some bozo like me forgot his umbrella.
Wow.
Than enjoy a party. Where does that kind of love come from? And that's what led to my, the beginning of my transformation, if you want to talk about it, and also later to my writing career.
When you talk about the transformation that you went through, and you start to put some of these stories down and you start to reflect on some of these, let's talk about the permanent transformation you had. It sounds like it's nothing temporary, and it sounds like that sometimes when people have these moments, it's all fun for a little bit, and then they go and they revert back to the way they used to be.
Right.
How has it been permanent for you, or how do you credit it to be something that has been a life-changing experience?
Well, I would say there's two ways that I would evaluate that for myself. Number one is that I battled severe depression on and off for my whole life from the time I was like 14 years old. And I was very, very successful in my career, but I had to fight off bouts of severe depression. And this panic attack that I had triggered a very, very deep depression. But in 1998, I had a spiritual experience 2 years after working with the monks for the 2 years. I had this spiritual experience, and since 1998 till this day, I've never had one moment of depression.
Wow.
So I can say that. The other thing is I can just see it in my behavior. The transformation that I'm talking about, when people say, okay, you had to answer the question, what is the purpose of life in 3,500 words? What is the purpose of life? Mm-hmm. Well, my point is the purpose of life for you, me, for everyone is exactly the same. We are here on this planet to become the best human being we can possibly be. And I define that as self-transcendence. And then I go on beyond that to define self-transcendence as the transformation from selfishness to selflessness.
Hmm.
And I go on to say that all life is longing for everything in life, all motivation is longing for transformation. An acorn is longing to become an oak, not to learn to be an oak, but to become one. And a caterpillar longs to become a butterfly, not to learn butterflyness, but to become a butterfly. But there's three kinds of transformation. When a thirsty man drinks, he transforms his condition. When a poor man hits the lottery, he transforms his circumstances. But when Mr. Scrooge wakes up on Christmas morning, an utterly new man, he has experienced a transformation of being.
Mm.
And a transformation of being is permanent.
Yeah. I've always looked at that, too, a proof. Always people say, how can you prove that God exists? And there's people that doubt the existence of it all. And I look at the way some people have transformed in their lives and say, how can you argue anyone's capable of doing that on their own?
I would agree with you 100%.
Yeah, and there's something bigger and more special going on there. Just think of everyone's human nature, of how easy it is for them to ignore these things or revert back or be lazy or, you know, be too scared or whatever it is. Just the mere existence that these transformations exist, I think, is proof alone that God works in people.
God works in people, but also we have to meet him halfway, because it means putting a lot of effort and energy and work in from our end, you know, our end as well, to try and live You know, as Aristotle said, we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence is not a choice, it's a habit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to become a different person, you behave like a different person, you do it over and over and over again, so that the becoming process is, you know, becomes hardwired into you. It's like perfecting the golf swing, you know.
Hmm.
And you know, a great golfer like Tiger Woods doesn't have a golf swing. He is a golf swing.
Wow.
And we have to get to a point where selflessness, you know, as I say in my book about business, I said the more successfully we forget our selfish motivations, the more successful we shall become.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our own self-interest to forget our self-interest.
Wow.
The more selfless you are, the more successful you'll be in every area of your life.
Do you own any chickens?
No, I don't. It's funny that you bring that up, though, because I do own a 75-acre farm.
Huh.
But I don't own any chickens. We tried to have some ducks around here a few years ago, and the varmints ate them faster than we could bring them in.
Oh, no.
We brought five or six flocks of ducks in, and each time we did, the foxes and the raccoons ate and chewed them up as fast as we could bring them in.
Oh, man.
But I have cattle. I have cows at the farm here.
Okay, well, that's something else. That gives you something to tend to, and probably gives you some things that gives you some alone time where you can be quiet and do your things. How often do you find yourself trying to replicate some of those same feelings you had at the monastery at your own home?
I don't. I don't try at all.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was when I went away to study theology a few years ago, and this woman gave us a little homily one day, and it's kind of corny, but I liked it a lot. You know, she took the quote from the Bible, "Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still, be." I am now the person that I am all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't try to get, you know, I don't try to put myself in this position or put myself in that position. This is the miracle that I could probably write another book about what has happened in my life since I went to the monastery and started working with the monks and the spiritual experience that I alluded to earlier. You know, I just live my life, and I see the same thing with the monks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just are who they are, and they aren't trying to find, you know, put themselves in this special mood or find this special place or... and it's a wonderful way to live.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the greatest, somebody asked me not too long ago on a podcast what my greatest achievement was in my life, and I said, you know, I was going into the gym 3 or 4 years ago, and some guy handed me a towel, mm-hmm. which was interesting because I'd never seen the man before, and they don't usually hand you a towel. They just have a box of them, and you pick one out. And this man goes to hand me a towel, and I reach out to grab it, and he wouldn't let go of it. And he suddenly just said to me, if you could be anywhere, doing anything, where would you be, doing what, right now? And without a second's hesitation, I said, I'd be right here doing this right now.
Hmm.
And as I walked down the hallway to the locker room, I realized my eyes had filled with tears.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that that answer had come from the very bottom of my being. Yeah, every minute of every day, in some mysterious way, I feel like I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing with my life.
Wow. You know, if people wanted to check out your new book, Brother John, A Monk, A Pilgrim, and the Purpose of Life, where can they find it?
Well, they can find it in a lot of bookstores around the country, but obviously the most, and they can come to my website, which is augustturek.com, August like the month, Turek, T as in Tom, U-R-A-K, which is one word, augustturek.com. Or, you know, the good old favorite, it's on Amazon. And,
the old favorite, huh?
Yeah.
Who,
you can always get it on Amazon.
Who did the illustrations and the paintings here?
Well, that's a wonderful story. I'm so proud of that. I mean, what happened was that over the years, people kept sending me letters telling me what a wonderful effect this essay that I had written had on them. And I wouldn't even know where they'd found it, because over the years, it became harder and harder to even find the essay. And then 2 years ago, or it'll be 2 years in August, a man showed up at my farm. He was from my bank. He was an executive at BB&T Bank. Mm-hmm. And he said his wife had walked out on him, and he was madly in love with his wife, didn't have an inkling anything was wrong with the relationship. She just left him. And he hit the skids, and he got suicidal. And he found my essay, Brother John, and that had won the contest, and it really helped him, and that sent him to the monastery, and he lived with the monks for 2 months, took a sabbatical. That turned his life around, and so as he was leaving the monastery, he asked Brother John specifically how he could come up to my house just to thank me, and he drove all the way 6 hours just to thank me for writing it. So I said to him at the time, I said, you're not the first person. I said, so I'm very flattered and humbled, but I also feel guilty. And he said, why would you feel guilty? I said, because I feel like I have a candle, a profound candle that's under a bushel basket because it seems to help people, but no one knows about it. So as soon as he left, I have a nonprofit corporation, so all of the proceeds from my books and my lecturing and anything in this field, I donate to my charity. Mm-hmm. And the woman who runs it, I said, we got to act on the intuition that I had. So I said, well, if we have a 3,500-word essay, it's not long enough to be a book, even with an introduction and a preface, which it has as well. But what if it was an illustrated book? What if So I got in touch with this guy. His name is Glenn Harrington, and I never have met him to this day. I've never met Glenn Harrington. And he got very excited about doing the paintings, but I didn't know anything about painting, and I didn't know whether he was the right man for the job, so I called my nephew, who works for Scholastic in New York, and I asked him to check this guy out, and he called me back the next day and said, my God, Augie, Glenn Harrington's famous. All the top publishers use him. He's illustrated 400 books. We pay him $15,000 for one cover for one book, and he's going to do 22 oil paintings for you? He said, grab it. So Glenn and I collaborated, so we got a $100,000 Templeton Prize-winning essay combined with 22 oil paintings from a multiple award-winning artist named Glenn Harrington, and the reviews for the paintings have just been fantastic. It's been almost more gratifying to me than hearing that people like the essay.
Wow. That's an awesome story. So the book, again, Brother John, A Monk, A Pilgrim, and the Purpose of Life, you can check it out on Amazon. Go check it out. If you heard any of the stories today, if any of them touched you, this is definitely worth checking out or maybe even gifting to someone you know. August Turek, thank you so much for sharing your stories here today on KMOX.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was really enjoyable. He joins us on the Quiver River Electric Guest Line. Great perspective from him. This is Overnight America, KMOX. About a half hour from right now, we're going to be joined with Drex. He does the late shift with Drex in Canada for Chorus Radio. One of the great radio companies in the business. It just so happens they operate stations in Canada. Chorus is really awesome. I mean, they're top of the line. And he does a late night show for all their stations, well, at least their talk stations at night. And he's all across Canada, so when we connect and do a segment together to talk about the State of the Union, we're going to be reaching all of North America. Canada, United States, Mexico, we're going to be in every nook and cranny. So I'm looking forward to that. That's a weird way to put it. Overnight America in every nook and cranny. That could be our next catchphrase. There's a couple of Ram stories out there. Yeah, Ram stories. One on KMOX.com. This was pretty good. Los Angeles Rams had a great season. They won the NFC West, won the NFC, and had a chance to tie the Super Bowl in the final minutes of regulation before losing. Los Angeles fans apparently were not heartbroken. For everyone that's telling me right now, oh, the fan base is so strong in Los Angeles, give me a break. I saw the crowds of their rallies, and it was non-existent. There's more people that show up just to go to Ballpark Village on a game day. Any given game day, it could be a Wednesday night. There's more people at a Ballpark Village than their giant Super Bowl rally before the Rams were heading to Atlanta. I thought, how are they a large area like Los Angeles? They get this NFL team, they're building this giant stadium, and there's barely any support for them out there. That's what they get, man. I just hope the Kroenke curse continues. So this is what they said. According to NBC's LA Rams and Lakers reporter, Michael Zidarte, it didn't take long for the city to move on. So this is what they're talking about. They don't care about the Rams. They were more interested in the Lakers acquiring Anthony Davis or the Dodgers trying to sign Bryce Harper. That was about it. Said overwhelmingly the answer was over winning a championship for a city, especially over Boston, which is a sour point to us. They chose acquiring Anthony Davis. That was their priority. They would have rather have landed a superstar. They already got LeBron James. I mean, they already got that. But they would rather have had another player come to the Lakers, because that's how they play in the NBA anymore. You have to stack your teams in order to win. It's not enough to have LeBron James anymore. But that was more interesting to them, acquiring Anthony Davis. Los Angeles area actually had a lower TV rating than the country as a whole when it came to the Super Bowl. Your team is in the game, and you didn't even have a large television audience. What does that tell you? Hope Kroenke looks at that, realizes. You know, I feel, again, this is just sour to be sour, but you know what? I hope every moment that he's writing another check for screwing this city over, that he thinks about the mistake he made. Maybe it's better he's gone, but still, I hope the Kroenke curse takes over Los Angeles. There's another story on KMOX.com. This is pretty good. Well, this is actually pretty disappointing. I was hoping that the Rams lawsuit would stay out of arbitration. I wanted them to open the books. I wanted all of this stuff to come out into the public for them to see and all to mock Kroenke and his terrible business practices. The brief of the Missouri Supreme Court last week may mean that the dispute over the now Los Angeles Rams leaving St. Louis could be headed to arbitration after all. The Court of Appeals reconsidering two rulings from last year that allowed disputes to remain in circuit court despite claims that the defendants be arbitrated. Comments by the state's high courts follows the Rams appealing an earlier ruling by the Court of Appeals Eastern District, which said the case could stay in circuit court in St. Louis and didn't have to go to arbitration. Aren't you just a little bit saddened by that? But still, as long as they write the check, the personal seats, the seat licenses, the PSLs, they've already lost that one, $24 million in that settlement. And one of the good things to that is the lawyer fees are not included in there, meaning they have to pay on top of that. So the people that were representing the PSL holders here in St. Louis, they get this settlement for $24 million, which will pay out the money they lost after the Rams left. And the lawyers that were there to defend them will be paid by Kroenke on top of that. So it's not like they have to divvy it up with all these lawyer fees. They'll get the money coming back to them, what's deserved to them, what's right for them. So that's pretty good, right? That website apparently is going to be posted here pretty soon. Post-Dispatch reports the site will go live February 16th, which is about 10 days from now. That's pretty good. I am looking forward to a couple of other big announcements. Did you see the one about, is it Oktoberfest? That's going to be coming right outside of our window here at KMOX, Soldiers Memorial, the great renovations here and the great space that they have in downtown St. Louis is going to be welcoming in the big Oktoberfest celebration, which is going to bring a ton of people downtown. We have the aquarium opening up. We have hopefully a Major League Soccer team coming to St. Louis. Who knows what's going to happen with the Cardinals this year? Let's hope for the best. And all of these things reflect positively on us in the community. All right, so coming up next, I want to bring up Barb Barrett. She's with Pew's Stateline, and every year they talk about what they believe are the biggest concerns and problems and issues facing each state. I want to talk to her what she thinks are the biggest issues facing Missouri this year next on Overnight America, KMOX. Joining us now is Managing Editor for Stateline, Barb Barrett. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's called the State of the State series. You came out with this the last couple of years, and last year we even spoke about some of the different topics. You look at issues that are really nationwide issues, but it affects different states in different ways. We looked at a couple of different problems that were affecting Missouri last year. I wanted to get your impression of what you think might have changed from 2018 when you were projecting what you thought would be the biggest issues compared to what you are now projecting to be some of the larger issues in 2019.
Well, one of the interesting things is last year we saw a lot of legislatures, especially in blue states, making a huge effort to push back against the Trump administration on various issues. I think you're going to still see some of that, But I think you're also starting to see, in certain ways, some alignment mm-hmm. between Republicans and Democrats in state legislatures. I'm not saying they're going to be singing Kumbaya up here on Capitol Hill in Washington, but on things like the opioid crisis, more pay for school teachers, what to do about prescription drug prices, even things like voting reforms, mm-hmm. you're starting to see a little bit more consensus, or at least conversations that are happening.
And there's been a lot of talk about increasing the funding that had been going to the states in order to help them fight opioids. And part of the pitch, too, that the president's made about a southern border wall is try to control some of the opioids and maybe drugs that are coming in from Mexico. So it's a lot of these issues are tied into each other if they're not directly standalone issues by themselves. So let's go one by one, some of the things that the study looks at this year, and let's talk about how you think they affect us here in Missouri. So prescription drug cost has been a topic for a while. We've had some out of control prescription drug cost. You know, they compare it to other countries, we're sky high. What have you found with that?
So across the nation, we're seeing a trend where state legislators are really eager to address the high cost of prescription drugs. There are efforts that, you know, could be challenged in federal courts. The federal government really doesn't want to relinquish much control on this issue to the states because, especially on issues like Medicare and Medicaid, the feds are very involved in this. But states have been sort of pushing back slightly. One example from Missouri is that there's a bill in your legislature now that would at least study the importation of drugs from Canada. So you mentioned, you know, the international thing. That's an example about something that's happening in your state.
Wow. School funding is another thing people are looking at, because here in the state of Missouri, of course, we put a lot of importance in schools, just like any other state would. So school funding, and last year, maybe even the year before that, but we were looking at proposals to arm teachers, and where are we going to find funding for training when it comes to some of the very serious issues that some schools are looking at when it comes to security of their schools. So how does school funding play into 2019, and what are those things they're looking to fund?
Well, probably your lawmakers in Missouri have been taking a look at their colleagues across the country that, you know, are looking outside their windows in their state capitol buildings and seeing teachers gathering outside protesting, you know, most recently in Los Angeles earlier this year where there was the big strike. And states don't want to be in that position, and so they're talking about adding more money to do things like school safety, but also things that teachers have really been calling for, such as caps on class sizes and more support staff and a pay increase. Different funding mechanisms depending on the state. In Missouri, Governor Parson has talked about another $61 million for K-12 education funding. He would add another $10 million to fund school transportation. They're looking at different ways to do this. You know, that's not always the most popular thing. Some people have criticized him for not talking enough about, for example, early childhood education and pre-K programs. But at the same time, it's definitely something that you're seeing more of now, that that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are talking a lot more about education and education funding.
Good. Census, too. We're coming up to 2020, and there's already been some fights about that, how we're going to handle it, what we're going to allow, what we're going to track, and how is that affecting this area?
So in some states, how many people you count is actually really going to make a difference in how much power you have in Congress. As your listeners know, I'm sure, the apportionment of the House of Representatives is based on state population. The more people you have, the more people you have in the House. Everybody gets two senators. And some states, California, Texas, Florida, California, Texas, and Florida might win or lose seats in the House based on how many people they have. Missouri is actually not in that situation. You're projected to say the same at eight seats in Congress in the House of Representatives. However, the more people you count, the more you can advocate for federal grants and other projects and programs that apportion money to you based on how much money you have. So Governor Parson has called for a committee to be put together in Missouri to take a look at how you can count more people, look at what you can do with those numbers. You know, these are things like, you know, this kind of helps the local agencies figure it out. where to put parks and playgrounds, how to determine the size of school classrooms. A lot of different things go into play when you're trying to figure out how many people you have and where they're located.
Mm. Barb Barrett joining us here on KMOX, Pew's State Line Managing Editor. And some of the topics that you're looking at in 2019 also include the election, even though we're kind of just coming off an election, November of 2018. But really, we're gearing up for another big presidential election. It's going to be a big one and a lot of fighting. I'm sure that's going to play a factor, even when we get close to the middle and end of next year or this year, when a lot of the candidates are going to start to surface.
Yeah. That's going to be a big deal. And one of the interesting things you're seeing is, as I'm sure your listeners saw, you know, it's not just about candidates going out and gathering votes. It's who gets to vote and how much access do they have to the ballot. And this has really become a big deal in the past year. And this is another area where you're seeing sort of both sides of the aisle kind of looking at things such as restoring voting rights to people who have been convicted of felonies. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal when that passed earlier this year in Florida. People mm-hmm. across the country paid attention because Florida is such a big state. Missouri has a piece of legislation that would allow that. You've also got legislation there that would expand early voting, allow for automatic voter registration so that when you go to the DMV to get your driver's license, hey, you also get to be signed up to vote automatically mm-hmm. unless you opt out. Expanding absentee voting and what's allowed there. Lots of different areas to get more people into the booth. Now, of course, there will also be people who are paying attention to, you know, concerns about voter fraud. So voting ID is still going to be a big deal in a lot of states. So you should expect to see that potentially bubble up as well.
Mm, that's interesting, the voter fraud side. And then the side of automatically registering you to vote would, I would think, be something that would be universally liked, but at the same time, that may play into the fraud side, where you just, you know, unless the person physically said they wanted to vote. But then it eliminates this whole rush at the end when people go up to the polls and they thought they were registered and they really weren't. Yeah, there's all kinds of conflicts with that. You also look at the opioids, because part of the problem we have here in the United States, we hear about opioids all the time. They affect pretty much every community. It's not just something here in just rural areas, but opioids by themselves is a major threat. It's being addressed on a federal level. How are they looking at it on a state level?
Well, states are paying attention to what's been happening on the federal level. You know, there was about $2 billion in federal grants that just got passed around in the past 2 years to help expand medical treatment of drug users, especially those who are affected by opioid abuse. And a lot of states, especially in non-Medicaid expansion states, such as yours, mm-hmm. are concerned about whether that money is going to continue. So different legislatures are looking at different things, maybe joining a lawsuit against the drug makers or considering whether or not to impose a tax on opioids. In Missouri, you guys are about in the middle of the pack when it comes to how badly impacted you've been by opioids. It's a huge problem. Recent statistics show that 1,300 people died from overdoses in 2017, which is, you know, a terrible. There was a recent study by the Missouri Hospital Association that found that it cost Missouri about $1.4 million an hour.
Ooh.
In terms of what the impact is for the opioid crisis. That's $12 billion a year.
Ugh. So gross to hear that number out loud. It's such a major issue all across the board. I mean, and I know that they're spending more money to fight it and more resources for different officers and paramedics. And I mean, there's so much that has to go into this sort of thing. It's just an entire mess that seems to be out of control right now. If I had to wager, I would say a majority of people know at least someone in the friend or family or colleague circle that it had some issues with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's like a spider web. It just sort of has tendrils everywhere.
It's terrible. Okay, so the report came out, and if people want to read more about some of these different topics on the report, if they wanted to read it in full, where can they go?
So you can find all of this at our website, which is stateline.org, as well as our other stories on what's happening in the states.
Stateline.org. Dateline.org.
Dateline.org, yep.
Yeah, get the full results from there. Pew's Stateline Managing Editor, Barb Barrett, thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you so much for having me.
And she joins us on the Quiver River Electric Guest Line. It's kind of a fascinating look at some of the issues in our state right now, ones that we know have been issues but will continue to be big issues as we move forward. Something very exciting happening in about 10 minutes at 106 when we come back from news, both national and local here on KMOX. We'll be connecting with The Late Shift with Drex. That means all of Canada and all of North America, all combined. It's like we're going to hug our Canadian friends. He's up in the, I think, Vancouver area, British Columbia area, broadcasting on the Chorus Network, which is a great group of owners. And he does the late night show in Canada like we do the late night show here in America. So we're going to broadcast on each of our radio programs together at the same time, simulcasting in a way. And we're going to discuss the State of the Union. We'll get his impressions as a Canadian, what he was looking at. I'm sure he'll have some questions for us as Americans. They follow a lot of American politics. So that's coming up next on Overnight America, KMOX.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.